Welcome to the third episode of the University of Oxford's COP29 podcast series on sustainable cities. My name is Dr. Catherine Maxwell, and today I will be speaking with Councillor Susan Aitken, leader of Glasgow City Council. In this episode, we'll be discussing the role of climate finance in enabling cities to reach their climate targets. Welcome to the podcast, Susan.
Thank you.
So let's get started. So COP29 this year was billed as the finance COP, and the negotiations were focusing on agreeing a climate finance target to fund climate action. So this is quite a critical stage, because without the funding, it's going to be increasingly unlikely that countries and cities are going to be able to limit global warming and also align with the Paris Agreement objectives. So with that in mind, I'd be interested to get your initial take on the kind of progress at COP29 on agreeing a global climate finance target.
Well, it's clearly fallen short, and I think there's no question about that. I look at the work that we've done in Glasgow to have clarity around what our financial needs are to decarbonise the city by our target date, of which is net zero by 2030, and the net zero route map that we've just produced, which is the most detailed piece of work that we've done so far in terms of understanding exactly how far we've come, how far we have to go, and how much it's going to cost. We're talking about between 24 billion and 37 billion for one city. Now, a post-industrial city with challenges where we need to do both mitigation and adaptation, but nonetheless, I don't think that's particularly an outlier in comparison to many of our peer cities, certainly in the developed world. So when you just think about that, you think 300 billion is clearly not going to cut it. Arguably it's a start, and I know that many of the protesters who at Baku who were rightly very angry. I wasn't at COP29 this year. I was at the U20 summit in Rio, which was on at the same time, where there was a big cities focus. But I know that lots of them were saying no deal's better than a bad deal. I'm not convinced about that. I think I come from a very kind of pragmatic point of view on this, is that we just need to do stuff. We need to get started. We need to be delivering implementation. And so take the 300 billion, get on with that, keep fighting for more. But 300 billion is not going to cut it for the scale of what needs to be done, either on mitigation or adaptation. And adaptation, of course, is often the more challenging bit to fund, but is particularly crucial for Global South countries.
Yeah. And just picking up on your point there around the implementation, because the discussions are moving towards actually implementing climate action on the ground, you know, the kind of logistical side of that and obviously the financing. Why is climate finance so important right now for cities and national governments? Because people listening to the podcast might think, okay, they've fallen short of a climate target, but what does that actually really mean? You know, what does it mean for me? So why is that the climate finance so critical at this moment?
But for cities, it's because cities are ready to implement. We're ready. We've got the plans. Mm-hmm. We know what we need to do. Cities are focused on delivery. We deliver every single day. We do the practical stuff, whether it's educating kids or providing care for vulnerable people or emptying bins, whatever it is, cities deliver every single day. And we are absolutely placed to do that in terms of climate action as well. But also, I think we're absolutely at a critical point at the moment in terms of securing any sort of continuing global consensus around climate action, indeed around kind of international climate agreements. The re-election of Trump will have emboldened a lot of climate deniers, a lot of those who would seek to backslide or indeed follow him in withdrawing altogether. So there's something really critical about, actually, we need to be demonstrating to our citizens right now that this absolutely can make their lives better in ways that are very relevant to them in their day to day. So, you know, just to give an example, in Glasgow, we know that having getting the finance that we need to deliver a retrofit will bring people's fuel bills down right now, particularly in older housing stock, in our what we call our pre-1919 tenement stock, where, you know, a fantastic model of mid-density urban living, which has survived well over 100 years for a good reason, but is thermally very, very inefficient. You know we could make a big difference with that right now for people. We know we could make a big difference, and we have a plan to transition the entire city to renewable source heat networks. We know how to do it. We know it would make a big difference as we do a major shift towards decarbonised transportation and mobility, a combination of much better public transport and active travel infrastructure. We're already investing in all of that and making people's lives better as a consequence. But to do it on the scale that we need to do it for the planet, we also need the finance in order to do it. So, it's very frustrating to watch the discussions at something like COP26, where national governments, where states are still talking about moving to implementation. At the U20 summit, which is an urban parallel to the G20 in Rio, which happened at the same time as COP29, we're already on implementation. We're talking, you know, the cities are actually sharing practical learning and examples with each other around delivery and finance, and the difference that's making for citizens, and how you maximise multiple benefits for every single pound or dollar or euro or whatever it is you're spending for delivery, how you then actually also address some of the deep-seated inequalities that all of our cities contend with, for example. So that's why finance matters so much. Mm-hmm. We can show people, we have the ability to show people right now that climate action, climate delivery can make their lives better. And for a whole number of reasons, we need to do that, because people have been going through a hell of a rough time recently, because they are vulnerable to the kind of siren voices of climate denial, who are saying this is too expensive, we can't afford this, you should be getting something else instead. We need to be able to demonstrate that actually this is the something else, this is for you, it's not just abstract, it's not just for something that's in the future, it's for the here and now.
That's a really interesting point. And just going back actually to you mentioned around the scale of finance required, and even, you know, for Glasgow alone, it's a significant amount. I think you said, was it 40 billion? Is that correct?
We started off with an estimate of between 30 and 40 billion. We've made progress from there, and we're now depending on and how fast we're able to go over the next few years, between 24 and 30 something billion we're looking at still for delivery. But a lot of that depends on the pace of delivery. So if we want to go faster, it'll cost a bit more, but then we get the outcomes more quickly. Or we could spend a bit less, but we don't get the outcomes as quickly as we'd like. But either way, it's a lot of money.
Yeah, it's significant. And Glasgow is obviously a global north city. How does the climate finance kind of differ in global south cities in terms of needs?
So I think the for global south cities, the adaptation need is often much more urgent than it is for global north cities. It's not that we don't have an adaptation need here, but the reality is that while we do have increasing flood risk and flood incidents in Glasgow, at the moment it's causing inconvenience. It's not killing people. People aren't being washed away in Glasgow by flood waters. People aren't dying from extreme heat. People aren't having their entire livelihoods and homes lost in mudslides. That's happening in the global south all the time. and it actually has been for a number of years. So the need for adaptation for both for heat and for flooding, particularly in the global south, is urgent and is existential. In a way that in the global north is very, very important, and we can't forget adaptation. It often gets forgotten about in the conversation. Adaptation needs to be hand in hand with mitigation, but it isn't. I think for most global north cities, there isn't that immediate sense of existential urgency. Yeah. Adaptation, though, is often more difficult to get the finance for, because there are less obvious returns for an investor in adaptation and resilience than there are for mitigation. So, for example, heat transition, there are obvious ways there, but I think of something like energy retrofit of existing homes and buildings is perhaps. It's both the adaptation and mitigation space, and it's probably the single most expensive piece of work that we need to do in Glasgow. Across the Glasgow metropolitan region, we've costed that up at about £11 billion worth of work in over about 400,000 existing homes. How do we create a financial package for an investor that delivers them that kind of return on patient capital for that? So that's one of the things that we are working on in Glasgow. We've got a wee bit more time to work our way through that, and in actual fact we are working just now as a city. We've invested in creating the capacity to build financial models that allow us to have the confidence to go into investor partnerships on for climate interventions. The Global South doesn't have that luxury, and they need that intervention now, and they need governments to step in, because, as I say, this is a space where private finance is going to be slower and more reluctant to step in. There are some things where it's going to have to be public money in one form or another, whether it's coming from national governments or from the World Bank, for example, that just steps in and does this stuff. And as I say, at the moment, it certainly feels like the amounts that they're talking about is falling far short of what's needed.
Yeah. And there's a noticeable, climate investment gap, with cities worldwide receiving around 7 or 8% of the climate finance currently required. What do you think are some of the broader kind of challenges that cities face when trying to secure climate finance?
So there's quite a few. Capacity is one. Cities we're by and large not set up to deal with finance at that scale. Mm-hmm. So to put it into context, in Glasgow in recent years, we settled a historic pay discrimination issue which my administration inherited, and which I took on when I became leader of the city, and said, right, we're going to settle with these women who have been discriminated against in an equal pay case. And the settlement ultimately was in the region of £750 million. That was huge. That was probably, the biggest financial deal that we had done as a city, and one of the biggest financial interventions that we'd ever had to negotiate and do all the work around, making sure that we first of all we could get the resource in, but also that it was sustainable for us to pay that back over a long period. And it was a massive thing at the time, and we were kind of like, oh my God, this is such a huge amount of money, £750 million. Not to underplay that, that's a very small amount compared to what we're talking about for major climate interventions. It's actually a drop in the ocean for the scale and pace that we need to go at to deliver heat and energy transition, for example, across the city. So and for us, that £750 million was a big deal. Most cities don't have folk, because it's not something that we ordinarily have to do, who are dealing with kind of finance at that scale and at that level, getting into the multiple billions. The investment, the work that we do, although most cities are very well versed in inward investment, it tends to be more in the space of things like maybe new housing or a new hotel or that a new office space, that kind of thing. It's often in real estate. It's not in often in the kind of scale of infrastructure change that we're talking about. We're actually of the very systems, urban systems that we function on, are going to have to change quite rapidly. So there's a capacity, a knowledge, a skills issue there, which cities who are able to are moving very fast to try and address. And we can do that actually in partnership with institutional and private investors, but that's a challenge to begin with. And there's a thing that my finance director always says to me: we can, anybody can borrow the money, it's paying it back that's the issue. At the end of all of this, we still have to deliver all those public services, and we need to have the confidence going into any investor partnership that those public services are not going to be affected, because that's first and foremost what we're here to do. That's our job. We have statutory duties that we have to deliver as a local authority, and all cities are in that position. So there is something about having the confidence that we can do this, that we can enter into financial deals without it coming back to bite our services and our citizens, where they end up losing out, because what we want is to make sure that there are multiple benefits. And I suppose that's the other part of it, is that the planning is really a big piece of work and a big ask, to make sure, if we're going to have this just transition that we all aspire to, and indeed is absolutely essential, then it needs to be properly planned. We need clarity about what it is we're delivering, what outcomes we're getting from that, obviously in terms of the contribution it will make to reducing our emissions, but also the contribution it will make to making places and lives better in all of our cities. So we need clarity around that. And then I think there is just this kind of culturally, big financial institutions don't really look to cities as the place to make investments, and so there's relationship building there. There's a real sort of cultural shift to happen, whereby cities and the world of finance are able to talk to each other, to understand each other, to understand each other's needs and requirements, and to be able to meet in the middle. I think it's a line I've said in the past. We all need to get over ourselves a little bit. So the public sector needs to realize that we're not necessarily the only ones that care about good outcomes for the environment and for the economy and for social outcomes. That actually there are plenty of investors out there who maybe are thinking about those things as well. And in fact, that's more and more common. But equally, the private sector needs to understand that the public sector can be effective, and that we can deliver that. That effective implementation isn't the prerogative of the private sector, that we are capable of doing it as well, and indeed have done. And I would argue that for all its faults and failures, in many places, it's been cities who demonstrated throughout the COVID pandemic that we are able to deliver, to move quickly, to adapt quickly, and to support our populations in times of crisis and make sure that we come out the other side. So I think more and more we are able to find that common space, but there's still work to be done there. And finally, I think national governments still don't get it. National governments are still, they're very focused on doing things at national level and creating national programmes. And frankly, it's slowing everything up. They need to be devolving levers and resource to cities and let cities get on with this, because cities actually are in the position to do the delivery that meeting nationally set targets demands, because it isn't happening right now. Without the urban transition, governments, so governments, in the case I'm talking about, both the UK and Scottish governments, are not going to be able to meet their targets. But they're still not connecting with the urban transition enough. They're not seeing it as the solution that it is and that they need to be seeing it as. So there's quite a lot in there. There's a whole number of things just now that are standing in the way of the money reaching the cities in the way that it needs to. But it is in everyone's interests for finance to be flowing to the cities much more readily and much more quickly than it is just now.
And do you think that, you know, with many cities around the world starting to, you know, come to grips with the different skills, as you mentioned, and knowledge that's required, and the confidence as well to secure that investment, a lot of cities are being quite proactive in mm-hmm. learning from each other and looking at best practice. How can cities effectively work together through different networks such as the C40 Cities Climate Leadership Group, you know, where there are opportunities to share that best practice to mobilise climate finance and then deliver on their climate ambitions?
We wouldn't have made the progress we've made in Glasgow in the past sort of 5 years if it hadn't been for the connections that we've made with other cities through those global networks like C40, like ICLEI, like the U20 and many others. In fact, I really should mention the Global Resilient Cities Network, since I am the chair of that. So the Global Resilient Cities Network, which is working in that very specific space of adaptation and resilience, and really bringing that particular perspective in to make sure that it's on the table along with mitigation. So, you know, we've certainly learned an enormous amount and been able to go at a much faster pace than we would have done otherwise. And specifically on financial models, we've learned very closely from Bristol and worked really closely with them. Their Bristol Leap model has just won, I think it was at the World Economic Forum, just won some awards and was acknowledged as being a real pioneer. We're working just now to create a Glasgow version of that, not just, you know, to adapt what they've done, to learn from it and have one that suits our particular circumstances as a city. We're very different from Bristol in a lot of ways, but they've done amazing work. They've done some really interesting work around financial models in London as well, with their London Edge model, which is a different kind of a model. It's an investment vehicle. The Bristol Leap is a delivery vehicle on energy transition, particularly. So loads to learn from there. You know, Rio and Nairobi and a couple of other cities are piloting a biodiversity credits scheme just now, which I think is really interesting, as something we are looking at in Glasgow, which is you know, where cities have are able to actually use our existing biodiversity as well as our plans for improving it to finance future investment in biodiversity, for example. So there's all sorts of incredible stuff going on in cities, and it is those networks, through talking to each other, sharing best practice, that will constantly improve our delivery, improve our outcomes, and, as I say, I think improve our offer in terms of investable propositions to the investors that are out there, to the climate finance that's out there.
And do you think then, without that kind of knowledge around climate finance and sharing that, the kind of skills and building that confidence, that without that, it will not really be possible to implement their climate actions? So, for example, developing a sustained and predictable flow of climate finance. So do you think that that's not going to be likely without kind of cities learning from each other, sharing and kind of building that momentum?
It will certainly be much, much harder, I think, if mm-hmm. cities are going out there and all having to act on their own without the knowledge that they're we're not on our own, that this is happening, that we're all grappling with this right now, and there's a lot to share and a lot to learn. So the Resilient Cities Network, for example, has all sorts of learning models that the chief resilience officers in the member cities are able to tap into, either online or connecting with each other, and really get that learning, get access to it quickly and easily, and then apply it, and get support to apply it to their own cities. That's just one example. Without the finance, it's not that cities won't be delivering climate action. We are, and we will, but the scale and the pace of it isn't going to be what's needed. You know, if we're serious, and collectively serious, and national governments are serious about, at the very least, still trying to keep 1.5 in our sights, but also planning for 3 degrees, and then the impacts that would have, that we have to protect people from. If we are serious about that, and I think most of the governments at COP29 are sincere, even if they're not, they haven't quite got their heads around what they really need to be doing yet, then it is in everybody's interest for the cities to be delivering at scale, and therefore it's in everyone's interest for the financial flows to reach cities. And if that sometimes means that they're bypassing national governments, or that they're going straight through national governments to cities, then that's the way that it needs to happen.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And there are multiple approaches that, you know, cities are currently taking to secure that climate finance that's required. You know, there's the regional development funding approach, which, you know, the City of Melbourne adopted to implement cycling infrastructure during the pandemic. And there's green bonds, which Cape Town has adopted to implement adaptation type projects. So there are different approaches that cities are taking. I'd be interested to get your view on, and from your experience, you know, how are cities accessing this climate finance at the moment? You know, going above and beyond, as you said, the critical kind of public services that, you know, you have to kind of protect. So how are cities accessing climate finance? What kind of approaches are they taking in your view?
So you've mentioned a couple already. There's green bonds and variations on those, biodiversity and kind of green space bonds, is, you know, particularly focusing on that side of things, is another emerging model. There's recognizing that sequestration and kind of carbon credits are a reality, and that a lot of companies are investing in that as a bridge to their own decarbonisation, recognising that it's not going to happen immediately. So they're investing in carbon credits, for example. Cities could be in a space with the right framework and the right assurances to benefit from that as well, through our own investment to be able to help the private sector demonstrate that their sequestration and carbon credit efforts are legitimate and are credible. There are the kinds of models that we're exploring in Glasgow, which we think are ones that we could make work for us, where the investment vehicle, for example, is a kind of a shared pot that different projects can bid into. The delivery vehicle is a kind of a partnership with a company, with the private sector, that also has the expertise to actually do the work. So, you know, dig up your streets, put in heat networks and connect buildings to it. You know, that's the kind of thing that's going to be happening all over our cities in the coming years. And again, we need the technical expertise to be able to do that. So if we're going to be going into relationships with folk with the technical expertise, then maybe there are partnerships that can be done around the investment flows that are needed for that as well. In the end, though, however we frame these things, they ultimately are borrowing. That's what it comes down to. It is, we are borrowing, and we're using our assets, whatever assets we've got as a city, as the the security of for that borrowing, or as the leverage for that borrowing, and that's the challenging bit, and that I think is where we could do with national governments standing beside and behind us as guarantors, almost, as you like, saying yes, this is a this is a safe investment, and we will make sure that it remains a safe investment. You know, should the worst come to the worst in a city, which actually I don't think is something that is something we're going to see happening very often. But should cities reach the point where they're not able to meet their obligations in terms of the borrowing, that national governments are there to stand behind them, recognising that all of this infrastructure, all of this investment isn't for nothing. It is actually, you know, it is an existential necessity, but it is also the biggest opportunity that we've got, climate action. And I don't think we're being, I don't think that national leaders are saying that often enough. I think there's too many of them trying to play it down. You know, Sir Keir Starmer said at COP29 that the UK government can deliver on its climate objectives without disrupting people's lives. It's just not true. Yeah. No, we can't. You know, of course we have to disrupt people's lives. Retrofitting a 120-year-old sandstone tenement is going to be disruptive for the people who live in that. You know, there are going to have to be expectations around culture change and behaviour change in the way, in mobility within our cities, the way that people move around, the way that they access transport, the kinds of transport that they use. We are going to disrupt people's lives. We are going to have to ask people to change the way that we behave, and we are literally going to have to go into their homes in order to do some of the key elements of that urban transition. The point is, though, that it will be worth it, that the outcomes of that disruption, if we do this right, will actually has the potential to make people's lives better, to improve their quality of life, to improve their health and their well-being, and to actually move us towards an economy that's much more sustainable in terms of the environment, but also much more sustainable and much more equitable in terms of the way that it impacts on our communities and on the people's quality of life.
And Glasgow has been quite exceptionally proactive in exploring that green investment, but alongside the just transition as well, with the recent green investment team plans. Just as we wrap up, you know, what kind of lessons have been learned to date from Glasgow's experience that could maybe be shared with other cities around the world? If there was a lesson that you could share around either setting up the green investment team or different types of funding, different types of projects or programmes, what would that be that you could share with other cities?
So I think a couple of things is relatively small amounts of investment by you as a city can make a big difference in terms of building your capacity, in terms of getting you into a place as a city where you've got that assurance and confidence that you can go ahead and enter into, you know, investor partnerships at a scale that you previously might not have been used to. So in Glasgow, we've committed just recently, it's not the first investment, but it's the biggest one so far. We've committed £4 million to grow our capacity, to both internally, but also to where we need to buy in some external capacity, particularly around legal and procurement knowledge. That is already putting us in a place where we know that we're on the right track, whereas maybe 2 years ago, we were still a bit kind of, okay, we think that we're in the right space, but really, are we having the right conversations? Do we really know what the needs are on either side? So that relatively small amounts of investment can make the difference. Take a wee bit of time. You know, a lot of us have set very, very ambitious targets, and I think that's really important. Cities, by and large, are more ambitious and are driving forward ahead of national governments, and we're pulling national governments behind us, which is really important. But we're also, a lot of us, looking at these targets and going, oh my God, the clock is ticking. Don't panic a bit. because this is a subject that requires urgency. But don't panic. Take the time that you need to get yourself into the right place so that when you go, you can go with confidence and you're not having to then take steps back all the time. You treat it as an iterative process, keep checking your homework as you're going along. But I think also if you're not talking to other cities just now, do it. Get in with these networks. Get active. Both at political and officer level, because it is the best tonic to be around other cities and to hear the discussion. If you know, for me, looking at what was happening in COP29 and feeling, it's very easy to feel very low and very despondent about what feels like a lack of progress. When you're around cities, you come out with a spring in your step because cities are full of purpose. There's real solidarity between cities on this, and real shared focus on implementation, on delivery, on our citizens, as well as on the planet. And if you're feeling a bit lost and a bit isolated in this space, you don't have to be. And there are lots of city networks there where a relatively small investment will bring you big returns in terms of partnership and learning and experience.
And helping to mobilise at scale.
Absolutely, at scale and at pace. And in the UK particularly, I mean, I'll always plug the Global Resilient Cities Network, but I would also mention 3CI, the Cities Commission for Finance, Cities Commission for Climate Investment. That's why we call it 3CI, it's much easier, which came out of COP26, which happened in Glasgow, of course, very much led by cities. The work and the modelling that 3CI are doing, which is quite, it's quite digestible. It's kind of bite-sized. You know, the net zero neighbourhood model, for example, is a way that even smaller cities or cities who are up against it financially can look and go, right, yeah, we could do that. Actually, that's something we could take on and deliver. And it is that kind of iterative, incremental process. None of us are going to be able to do this in one go. If we do need to do it at pace and scale, and there are lots of folk there who are developing ways that are allowing us to up the pace and scale in a way that's manageable and that is within our grasp and is not going to leave us kind of floundering and in a space where, as I say, our public services and our citizens are being put at risk as a consequence.
That's great. Susan, thank you so much for your time and your insights. It's been fascinating to hear your perspective on sort of financing urban climate action and the kind of ambitious role that Glasgow City Council is also playing to reduce emissions and achieve net zero targets. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Good to speak to you.
Thank you for listening. In our next episode, I will be speaking to Mark Watts, Executive Director of C40 Cities Climate Leadership Group. We'll be reflecting on COP29 and exploring both the progress made as well as the key challenges that cities must overcome to deliver on their climate commitments.